Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 13th of October 2018, episode 4. I've just had a few or one mishap where a podcast got mangled. For some reason, it's just one of those things. For some reason, this podcast thingo stores MP3 as capital M, capital P, capital capital 3. Therefore, that cocked up. I lost a bit of a podcast last night. Going along, reading what things are happening. Now, this is obviously another CRISPR gene drive article. It's called, from page 24, Remote Control. The power to eliminate wild species using a gene drive needs to be curbed, says Simon Terry and Stephanie Howard. So this is in the comment section, so you'll get an opinion with it. But let's describe what a gene drive is. So genes are DNA. The DNA can have little... I suppose molecules on top of it, which stops and starts it. So in the presence of chemicals, it can respond, produce chemicals. It can do all sorts of different things it's pre-programmed to do. And it can actually be programmed to produce a genetic engineering lab. So what happens is that when you have a one of these genetic engineering labs in, the genetic engineering lab, which produces a gene shear and a reader, goes up and does several things. It creates the mutation, which will have an effect down the track, and it also conduct a mutation. Well, what it does is in bacterial world, there's bacteria able to produce a little genetics engineering lab with a marker for DNA and a shear, and it would go up and attack rogue DNA, the place, either in itself, if the DNA has managed to get into itself, or in other places, if the virus is coming in, the virus keep on going and keep on cutting it. And if it's virus then rebuilt itself, or the gene rebuilt itself with no change, it would still be there, it'd be read and cut again, again and again. This is one of the things I didn't realize with this Cas9 CRISPR code. So it's clustered, regularly interspaced repeats, interspaced palindromic repeats. That's what CRISPR stands for. So you actually encode, your CRISPR encodes itself and says, and cuts the gene and inserts its CRISPR engineering machine into the gene. So what happens is the father's gene actively goes across, if it's from the CRISPR stuff's in the father's gene, goes across and sets up a CRISPR lab in the mother's gene. And so what happens is that the next generation will get 100%. All of the offsprings of the next generation will have CRISPR labs in them. And so these CRISPR labs, which ensure that 100% of the offspring has these characteristics, will have all these CRISPR labs. So that's okay, that won't kill a species, but you add another thing which does kill it and knock it out. And so you can actually... the ultimate of genetic engineering is you can genetically engineer something that is capable of genetically engineering itself out of existence to kingdom come. And that, my friends, is gene drives. Now let me read this, and I'm of course having a rest, obviously I'm still suffering from rehab, so as I read along I sort of run out of steam and puff. But let's read this. Thanks to a form of genetic engineering technology known as the gene drive, it's now possible to modify or even eliminate a wild species in its natural habitat, bypassing the laws of inheritance that have governed nature for millennia. The power to deliver extinction to order is potentially immense, as is the political challenge. The technology works by driving a gene throughout a population, meaning the plants or animals containing the drives would impact ecosystems that cross not just country borders but entire continents. And so far, there is no such thing as a safe gene drive or a reliable way to rein in one after release. What actually happens in real life is that gene drives only work for a certain number of generations. So far, I've found out. It may change differently. A number of authoritative bodies, including the US National Academy of Sciences, have called for international governance of technology. In a recent study, the Sustainability Council of New Zealand, where we work, suggests that countries proposing a gene drive trial or release must first gain consent from each country that it could affect, a process we call collective consent. This requirement is based on a principle at the core of international biosafety protocol established throughout the United Nations. It says that countries importing living genetically modified organisms have the right to prior informed consent. But consent is not enough. Certainly abounds where gene drives are concerned. So it's essential. Uncertainty abounds. It's essential to apply the precautionary principle when undertaking risk assessment and to evaluate gene drive proposals against alternatives that could achieve the same goals. That is, if you want to get rid of flies, just swat them all. Methods of curbing the potency of this new technology have been, and it's really interesting, you know, that these, you find out that these pests actually do something vital, proposed such as trying to reduce the lifespan and the geographic spread of a gene drive, but none yet have been demonstrated, and all carry similar risks. So you could have, yeah, I don't know how you do it. A failure to insist on proper governance invites a wild west of unilateral actions without proper consideration of risk alternatives and consequence of other countries. So there's the New Zealand itching to gene drive its possums out, but the possums could then go back to Australia and wipe out our possums, which really means that you need, if possum goes thoroughly extinct in the area, you can reintroduce it. So there's a bit of interest. The UN Convention on Biological Diversity could be adapted to deliver what is needed. It is the most suitable structure currently available on which to build gene drive governance. And until that is completed, international agreement is needed that no outdoor trials or releases will take place. However we do it, there is no time to waste. There's just 3 years after a gene drive was first proposed, scientists are hailing significant progress in gene drives of mosquitoes and mice. In November, when the UN Convention parties meet in Egypt, the international community has the opportunity to lay the groundwork to govern the gene drives. It should not let this opportunity pass. What do you think is a case for malarial mosquitoes? I really do. Okay, just in terms of, I'd be listening to that. And obviously the entire thing is a lot of people listen to things ready to make a judgment, or I listen to try and find out what more information I need. Political science. US conservatives are gearing up for an assault on reproductive rights, says Lara Williams. Oh, God. The Trump administration has launched a review of state-funded research that uses fetal tissues, prompting many to speculate it is the start of a fresh battle on abortion rights in the US. The Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, has announced that it is cancelling a contract for advanced bioscience resources to supply the Food and Drug Administration's FDA with fetal tissues for research purposes. HHS was not sufficiently assured that the contract included the appropriate protections applicable to fetal tissue research or met all the procurement requirements, the department said in a statement. Oh, God, I hate regulators like that. You really need, there's got to be a new structure, because at the moment the regulators are too easily corrupted. This is in education, hotel industries, you just name it, they're just so easily corrupted. If you were wanted to corruption and you stopped, you then just move your focus onto the next area. Okay, this was followed by an announcement of a full audit on the use of such tissue. In the US, $98 million of grants, contracts, and other state spending are dedicated to fetal tissue research just last year. My God. It has been instrumental in developing vaccines and fighting diseases such as Zika. Even so, research using embryonic stem cells and fetal tissues is heavily policed. Several states such as South Dakota, Florida prohibit the use of such cells in research. And there is a staunch restrictions on profiting from their supply. And the HHS now suggests these controls are inadequate. As you would if you if you've been taken over by zombie controls. This zombie thing that is that it no longer operates on rationality. It operates on, oh, I've got a job here because I've got a value to a lobby group. The move is a troubling one from the administration headed by the pro-life president, the most pro-life president in modern history. In the words of one supporter, Trump has stocked the HHS with anti-abortion advocates with evident results. In October 27, the HHS released a strategic plan that declared its purpose as protecting Americans at every stage of life, beginning at conception. Oh my God. Oh my God. What is this? You actually, I don't know whether you're an American at conception. Well, honestly. Because you could have fly for a romantic night in Paris or Berlin. And then you're only an American if you, I think, land in America and get born within the borders of America. Look, I don't know. I don't know how that works. I really don't know how that works. And the cancellation of the HHS contract came soon after. God, I just hate this. You know, really, you almost need a mathematical number you can plug in and say, oh, look, they're cracks. 85 member of the House of Representatives sent a letter to FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb declaring that, quote, the practice of conducting research using body parts of children whose lives have been violently ended by abortion is abhorrent. This leaves little doubt to the true motives underlying the order. And it's also stupid. Why would you do that? Why would you, if you're trying to rob someone, saying, "G'day, miss, mate, I'm the robber. I've turned up. Look, I, respect for you and your property. Just don't have it. I've got to go in. I've got a robbery to do." Okay. This is more than an audit on scientific research. This is a deeply ideological gambit opening the door for further debate on women's agency and bodily anatomy. Well, I don't quite understand that one. Wind powers warming effect overblown. Michael LePage. A study has claimed that if the US generated enough electricity from wind to meet its current demand, the surface of the continental state would warm by 0.24 degrees Celsius. Wow. It's going to warm by that anyway if it keeps on doing coal. What's more, it goes on to compare the increase with global warming. Quote, this is an idiot survey came across it. Large-scale US wind power would cause warming effect that would take roughly a century to offset, claims the headline on a press release issued alongside the study, implying the savings of greenhouse gas emissions wouldn't counteract the warming for 100 years. Other climate scientists say this big claim is misleading, as I would say. It's like, God. For starters, the study assumes the scenario where a third of the US is covered by wind turbines, says the wind energy researcher Christiana Archer of the University of Delaware. Quote, that means you jump in your car in Idaho and drive all the way to the Rocky Mountains, and all you see at every point is wind turbines, she says. It's a crazy scenario that is never going to happen. What's more, the study relied on a regional climate model called the WRF. This model has a known flaw that exaggerates the air mixing effect of wind turbines two or three times, says Archer. Then there's the comparison with global warming. The crucial point here is that wind turbines simply redistribute heat that's already in the air. At night, for instance, the ground cools and so does the layer of air just above it. The turning of the turbine blades heats the surface by bringing down warmer air from above. The overall heat content of the atmosphere does not change, and the effect ceases when the turbine stops turning. By contrast, high levels of carbon dioxide trap heat, increasing the heat content of the atmosphere. The effect lasts for millennia because extra CO2 persists in the atmosphere for that long. To put it another way, even if this study is right about the magnitude, of the effect, every inch of land in the world has covered with wind turbines, it wouldn't cause the melting of polar ice caps. The impact of wind farms has to be considered in the context of all other changes we're making to the world. The Ermine Heat Island effect can warm cities as much as 12 degrees compared to the surrounding areas, but has a negligible effect on global temperatures. Buildings affect winds too. Some of these points are stated in the paper, but they are buried two-thirds of the way through. They are not made clear in the press release. Oh my God, there's a lot of press. CSIRO's been doing lots of crap press releases. Okay, asked whether the headline of the press release might cause misleading coverage, co-author David Keith of Harvard University replied, "I expect so. People will seize on all sorts of stuff and exaggerate it. Not us, other people." Keith is not doubting the need to move away from fossil fuels. "There is no question that wind is better than coal," he says, but he is concerned about the impact of large-scale wind generation. Archer thinks research should stick to analysing realistic scenarios for wind power. Quote, "It gives such a bad reputation to wind if you start publishing this kind of stuff," she says. "People don't see that it is a crazy scenario. All I remember is, oh, there's a global warming of wind power," except there isn't, of course. Yeah, I think that's... It is interesting. We also got to reduce the amount of fuel we use. Okay. This is another advertising feature. Oh, this is probably reasonable. Sorry for reading these features this time. Because they're well-written articles at the end of it, because they've been corporately massaged, people have gone through it and said, people are paying for this article. The future, lower carbon products. Reducing greenhouse emissions requires some innovative advances, such as jet fuels made from cooking oil and concrete that absorbs carbon dioxide as it hardens. Now, that is interesting. That's interesting. Concrete absorbs carbon dioxide as it's hardening. You've got to get the carbon dioxide in there. It's a bit confusing. You probably, that's a bit complicated. How does it happen? Oh, let's read what this BP person, the BASF, did. One concrete. This is polymer concrete. It's making it pour and set and all this. Now, this one's looking at it from a different aspect of the carbon footprint of the cement. But bear in mind, carbon, I think it's 8% is concrete. So, yeah, I don't know. It's like one day a fortnight, your effect of barbecuing is from someone just putting in a concrete patio. When it comes to greenhouse gas emissions, it's easy to focus on coal-fired plants and internal combustion engines, but another major source is less well known, the manufacture of cement and concrete. You betcha. Quote, "The cement manufacturers are second largest emitters of carbon dioxide in the world," says Tom Schuller, president of Solida Technology in Piscataway, New Jersey. "They produce 5-7% of all the man-made carbon dioxide that's emitted." Well, that's a bit lower. The manufacturer. There must be other things. "That's partly due to the sheer scale of the industry," says Schuller. "The concrete is the most used material on the planet after water." I've got to really think whether that's true. Okay. "And the chemical process involves making cement and concrete have always emitted carbon dioxide. Now Solida has a way to rein it in. Cement is essentially made of calcium and silica." I would say calcium oxide. I don't think it's calcium metal. "Generally in the form of limestone and sand, respectively." Okay. "Cement manufacturers mix the two parts of limestone to one part stone, and that's, it's not Portland, and then heat the heat, heat the mixture to a kiln to 1500 degrees Celsius, transforming it into cement. Well, I think cement is typically the wet cement, transforming into cement powder. The method was barely changed since the 1814 when Joseph Aspidin and his son William developed the patent of the Portland cement. The process produces carbon dioxide in two ways. First, the heating of the kiln, usually through fossil fuels. The second, ensuring chemical reaction which breaks down the limestone and liberates the carbon dioxide. Silica has a new approach that releases far less carbon dioxide. It uses the same raw materials, but they're 50-50 rather than, 66-33, which is actually not that much, that's 16. The heat to a lower temperature of 1,200 degrees. This cuts the source of carbon dioxide and uses less limestone and fossil fuels. If you went back to Roman, magnesium dioxide, magnesium carbonate. Another advantage too, cement is usually mixed with sand, water and aggregate rock fragments to make concrete construction. Water reacts with the cement, causing it to harden and causing a process called curing. Well, it hydrates, it hydrates the hydroxide, the calcium hydroxide. Solita cement cures in a different way, by reacting with carbon dioxide that is pumped in. You actually see the concrete pick up about 5% weight, that's carbon dioxide converting to essentially limestone. Is it just rebuilding the limestone? I suppose it is a concrete. Concrete is a form of instant limestone. But if you add water, it increases the weight of the water. The water doesn't evaporate, it reacts. Most people think it does evaporate. This part is of a small but growing effort to capture the carbon emissions. It may be more cost-effective to put concrete plant next to a source. One potential source will be an oil refinery. That's one reason BP has invested in Solita technology. Solita has been included in BP's Advancing Low Carbon Accreditation Program. That's helping it drive low carbon thinking across the company. British Petroleum. It's just really interesting how you get the carbon dioxide in there. For now, Solita is focused on getting its cement concrete used in major manufacturers. To encourage uptake, Solita process is designed to be similar as possible to existing practice so manufacturers can use existing equipment and raw materials. Ultimately, Solita wants to help address climate change. Our goal is to turn carbon dioxide from a problem to a solution, says Julia. I have my extreme doubts about that because concrete is such a well-known, if you're using it for low-value stuff, you don't have a lot of, there's a lot of extra headroom to use it. You're putting out a footpath. The problem is that's low cost. But it is driven by low cost. People are competing. Lots of people know how to do that. If you want to use it at a high cost thing, you want the study's just not there. Okay, there's a second article called BP Biojet. Mm-hmm. The most important thing is just to say, limit the amount you fly overseas, I would think. Aviation is a significant source of greenhouse gases. Today it accounts for about 2% of the global emissions, says Tom Parson, Biojet Commercial Development Manager, BP. That's not a huge share, but without improved efficiency, aviation emissions will continue to increase. It will become 3% by around 2050 if no action is taken. The International Air Transport Association wants to halve aviation's net carbon dioxide emissions by 2050, relative to the 2005 levels. But how? They want to do it. Cutting emissions from aeroplanes is difficult compared with road, rail transport, where options include Electrification of vehicles has passed since you physically can't get enough battery weight to make those planes fly at this stage, or at any stage. Instead, BP is focusing on how conventional airplanes fuel, essentially high-grade petrol. Is that kerosene? Oh, petrol, okay. Can be replaced, isn't it rocket fuel? You know, basically jet fuel? Yeah, well, let's go. Jet fuel, I think it's a thing. And the main thing is to stop it producing carbon soot in the engine. Can be replaced with a more sustainable equivalent. This is where BP Biojet comes in. So I just wonder how they, what they did to rocket fuel. I think it's R1 rocket fuel and jet fuel of J something or other. They added that. It's not about the energy, it's about whether it produces carbon soot. Until recently, waste oil from restaurants was typically poured into landfill sites. There it decays to produce methane, another greenhouse gas. That can have a negative impact on the environment. So BP is using recycled oil in its new green airplane fuel. Oh. Just that this, I mean, diesel is a lot easier to make. And, you know, if we could replace diesel, it'd be really great. You know, that's, I don't know my overall feelings there. Or for ships, something like that. You know, and you don't have to put as much energy into refining it. Okay. First, tankers collect the used oil from restaurants for processing fuel. So let's do a few calcs here. I would say that you'd be pushing trussel to get a, I don't know, probably a ton, a tanker full a week, sort of like nothing. Okay, but, and we shouldn't be fat firing our food anyway. Sorry for being a killjoy. Wait, it's aggregated, it's cleaned up a bit, and then it goes to a specialist biorefinery, i.e. there's bugs in here. And there it undergoes chemical reaction with hydrogen to remove excess oxygen and give it the properties that make it practically indistinguishable from fossil jet fuel. That has a carbon footprint as well. I'm just trying to think, especially make, so you make, pump in hydrogen, the hydrogen resaturates the fat. The new fuel can be carried in existing pipes to tankers and pumped straight into planes. You don't need to modify the planes, nothing's needed to change. Planes can't yet fly solely on biojet because aviation fuel must consume a small amount of ring-shaped organic molecules called aromatics. Well, I'm just trying to think how that actually works. So aviation biofuel has to be blended with ordinary fuel. You can have a 1-to-1 ratio with conventional jet fuel. BP already sells this blend of 3 airports in Norway and Sweden. When a person books a plane ticket from a company that uses BP biojet, they may be offered the option to pay extra. Uh-huh. If they opt in, the money is used to buy biojet, although their flight might not be one that uses it. In practice, planes tend to fly with a small percentage of aviation biofuel. It's like, it's not 50-50, but it's a little bit. Even that makes an important contribution. Biojet reduces greenhouse gases with standard fossil fuel jet. I mean, the major thing is disposing of what you're going to dispose the fuel anyway. One of the key reasons is being accredited with BP's Advancing Low Carbon Program. However, using cooking oil will never supply enough fuel for all the world's airplanes. So BP is looking for other resources of low carbon feedstock. For instance, the person says it could be possible to make fuel from household solid waste. There's even potential to convert excess renewable energy into liquid fuels, he says. Oh my god. No signal technology is enough to slash aviation emissions. We're going to need everything. There was information there, but it's almost depressing as you read it. Okay, the ghosts within. This is a cover story. We are 29 minutes in. And this is, I think we're Neanderthal Denisonians, and our link we've built on solid evidence from DNA studies. So I think Dysonian, Neanderthals were found whole things. We found shells, sites, cave paintings, Neanderthals, they're really just not such a big. I think we should mourn lost Neanderthals. Neanderthals, there's just a finger. I think I found one finger. That was enough, but that's enough to fill in the stuff. So, I suppose it's here that you can see a lot, just a bit of information, or perhaps there's another step we don't, a third party. So, hidden with our genomes are traces of completely unknown species. Catherine Barwick investigates. So a genome, I think, so a karyotype is your genes all broken up, your genetic chromosomes all built up and actually set out, so you can actually observe it. So that's a particular way of doing it. A genome, I think, is the actual genetic information of your genes. We learn about our ancestors in many ways. Bones tell us what they looked like, teeth reveal their diets, tools, pots, arts, and other artifacts hold stories about their culture. So this is Catherine Barwick, investigates. Then a decade ago, the first ancient genome was sequenced, opening a whole new window to our past, one that promised more intimate insights. Breakthrough frames revealed that Neanderthals got very cozy with humans. So much so, I think we're 5 to 10% Neanderthals. I think there's more in others. I think that would be absolutely fascinating. You can imagine, sort of, you know, if people aren't on side on the human race. Okay. Since then, geneticists have been probing more fossils for evidence of past cross-species dalliances. That is, you know, hey, Neanderthals, you're not so bad. The studies haven't disappointed, but in an intriguing twist, they've started to kick up something unexpected. Hidden inside genomes are signs of ancestors we never knew existed. Geneticists call them ghosts. We have no physical records of these ancient hominids, no bones, no tools, no archaeological remains whatsoever. Yet the genetic code that they left within fossils of other hominids and living humans too. Oh yeah, okay, fossils is something which is once alive and is all the thing, and humans too, is offering profound, unprecedented insights into how our species came to be and what the world was like at the time. The idea that each of our cells might contain fragments of genetic code from extinct species has been around for well over a decade. Well, I just think, distinct races, I'd say. I don't know whether you can say it's a separate species, because there are sort of due to gene hopping tiny fragments of snake DNA in our cells. You know, just really crazy things. They're from different species. But, I think hominids are things. Then, in 2008, Savanti Pablo, so that's P-double-A-double, and the two A's have got Dioruses on. I think he's the one that... and his team at Max Planck Institute of Evolutionary Biology in Leipzig, Germany, pulled off the masterstroke of teasing DNA out of millennia-old Neanderthal bones in quantities great enough to sequence. This provided an obvious way to find out if Homo sapiens had bred with Neanderthals. Homo neanderthalensis. Neanderthalensis. You would simply look within the genomes of living people for DNA sequences with distinctly Neanderthal patterns of mutations. Well, I think it's not so much, it's just the age. Yeah, you can do that, but it's just that if you're a modern human, you've got DNA from a certain point. If you've got another piece of much more varied DNA, it's been mutating for a much longer time. I think that's it as well. Now, these comparative studies reveal early humans had indeed mated with Neanderthals, and not just once. Well, I would like to say fallen deeply in love with them. Wanted to start up a future, a family, we can get together. Current estimates are that everyone except Africans are between 2 to 4% Neanderthals. Okay, I got it wrong. Unexpected dalliances. Oh, yes. Here were two clearly distinct species separated by up to 700,000 years of evolution. I think that's the main thing. You can see how long they've been evolving by the complexity of their genes. Yet, the remnants of their sexual proclivities are captured in the DNA for the majority of people alive today. Ooh. Mm. What's more, it soon emerged that our ancestors were only getting it on with Neanderthals. Just as Pablo was finished sequencing Neanderthal genes, a parcel landed on his desk. It contained a tiny fragment of finger bone from Ate Mountains in Siberia. Adelaide Mountains in Siberia. I think I do remember that from a 1930s airship adventure. You can imagine that. Oh, that person. You think he may have been a Japanese mafia person. The piece was 30,000 to 50,000 years old and was thought to be from another Neanderthal. His team was in for a big surprise. The DNA analysis revealed an entirely new group of archaic humans, now dubbed the Denisovians, which slipped from the common ancestor with the Neanderthals some 500,000 years ago. So Neanderthals up to 700,000 years ago, they split separately there. And you can see all the splits. It's a beautiful mathematical thing. It's like mathematical Sudoku. Once again, comparisons with modern human genomes show that two interbred. Oh yeah, so we can now spot some Denisovians. Genetic studies reveal this happened in Eurasia. They also show that Denisovians ran from Siberia to Southeast Asia. I think Melanesians were Aboriginals. The people in the Maori and Hawaii are Denisovian. And let's see. And this is interesting. And at least one of their genes helps modern Tibetans to live at high altitude. And that's a bit of iffy, isn't it? The idea that our ancestors hybridized with one another was once dismissed. Now it's starting to look as though they wouldn't mate with anything vaguely human. Only they're clubbing. Oh, it's only lots of few drinks. It would be interesting if there was drinks and something disease. No. Denisovians were nearly ghosts. We have one finger bone and a few molars as a physical testament to their existence. But no more. If I was writing this, typical New Scientist, one finger bone pointing to it. Yeah, it would be, do it, but he hasn't done it. He's writing this. It's Catherine. But yeah, it's interesting that female authors stay clear of dad jokes. Okay. Then, in 2016, a true ghost emerged from the genomes of 44 individuals who lived in the Middle Eastern region between 14,000 and 3,400 years ago. And that's sort of brain-twisting. How you know they're related? I don't understand. They lived isolated? I don't know. Genetic markers indicative of a distinct group of ancient Homo sapiens based on a region, in the region more than 45,000 years ago. The members of this population, known as the Basal Eurasians, and they present a conundrum. So, are the Basal Eurasians in all of us? I don't know. Let's find it out. The DNA, which is still found in modern Europeans, shows none of the telltale signs of interbreeding of Neanderthals. This came as a surprise because ancestral humans mated with Neanderthals very soon after leaving Africa 60,000 years ago in the migration that was to give rise to all peoples of non-African heritage alive today. The most likely explanation is that soon after the migration, a group of humans became isolated from the rest and bumped into and mated with Neanderthals. If you like, it's a third branch, says Christina of the Natural History Museum of London. A branch that is distinct from the humans who had stayed in Africa and the ones who gradually spreading across Eurasia, Australia, and eventually to the Americas. Okay, I find this a bit hard to go. They've got a nice diagram here. So we've got a diagram of it all. And on page 32. Okay, they're throwing ones. They've got humans branching off from everybody else. Ooh. Yeah, I have a lot of difficulty with this. Oh, no, I do have a difficulty with this diagram. Well, humans branched off, so they've got... any humans have branched off to four things. And the Africans are distinct from the Europeans, Asians, and ghost population of Basal Eurasians. The Africans have interbred with Neanderthals in Africa, but those African Neanderthals are not in the Europeans. The Europeans bred with full-on European Neanderthals. The Neanderthals bred with Denisonians, and there's Denisonians from one finger. They think they bred with another ghost population of really super archaic, super evolved. So if you've got a chunk of DNA and the randomness goes up, and so it's like you get it's like the tread on your DNA. The tread is much thinner. You know that DNA is from something else. So it's a tree. It's on page 32. And there's animals have ghosts too. Because there are no known fossils belonging to Basal Eurasians, it's impossible for now to say why they're isolated. Perhaps it was just down to where they settled. So they're just a group of Europeans which... This is really confusing. So, I don't think this is actually done correctly here. I'd just reread it. They're the same as Europeans, but they didn't mate with Neanderthals. This is what the diagram says here. These people only mated with Europeans, Asians, and... Oh, this is doing my head in. Let's read this one again. So I think the diagram may be wrong. I hate this, because I'm just going through helping heaps of kids with their HSC. Sorry, guys. Struggling with that diagram's wrong in the exam. That one's wrong in the exam. Okay, let's reread this one again. Okay. Then, 2016, a true ghost emerged from the genomes of 44 individuals who lived in the Middle East between 14,000 and 3,400 years ago. Okay. So that for one dig. Is that one area? I don't know. Their DNA held genetic markers indicative of a distinct group of ancient Homo sapiens based on the region more than 45,000 years ago. The members of this population, now known as Basal Eurasians, and they had presented a conundrum. Their DNA, which is still found in modern Europeans, shows none of the tell signs of interbreeding with Neanderthals. Okay, so they didn't breed with the Neanderthals. So they said, nah. And this came as a surprise because the ancestral humans mated with Neanderthals since they came after leaving Africa 60,000 years ago. In the migration, that would give rise to all people of non-African heritage today. Okay, so... These modern humans came up and they missed those sexy Neanderthals, you sexy Neanderthal. The most likely explanation is that soon after migration, a group of humans became isolated while the rest bumped into the mate with Neanderthals. Okay, if you like, this is a third branch, says Christopher Stinger of Natural Human Museum in London. A branch that is distinct from humans who had stayed in Africa and one who were gradually spreading across Eurasia. Well, they're not really ghost branch. I think that's misleading. They're not a new branch. I think this article's really misleading. They do actually have a ghost I mean, it's a different branch, but they haven't done anything particularly unusual. There's not another thing. Okay, because there's, okay, the basal Eurasians, so these are just pure, the most pure humans we know, the pure modern humans. They didn't get any benefits from the Neanderthals. They found those sexy Neanderthals were just not good enough for them. The basal research showed that rich insights into human history can be gleaned from DNA alone. But, like the Neanderthal and Denisovan studies, it relied on obtaining DNA from fossils, something that remains a huge challenge. DNA degrades with time, so it takes special fossils and special skills to extract it from very old bones, particularly ones that have spent thousands of years buried in hot climates. Whoa. I just find this a bit... Oh, yeah, I suppose I'll allow to say that. Among others, Jeffrey Wall, now at the University of California, Los Angeles, and Vincent Plagnol of the University College of London, suggest that it might be possible to spot signs of extinct populations in the DNA of modern humans simply by using clever statistics. I bet you, mate. The broad idea is that all DNA is subject to random mutations that accumulate over millennia and are passed down from generation to generation. By looking at mutation patterns in modern populations, it's possible to spot segments that don't match the usual Homo sapien patterns. The thing is that this person, not, besides being a ghost, they're just a boring thing. I don't know. These are presumed to come from populations that evolved separately from our own species for thousands of years before mating with humans. Well, yes, but you wouldn't be able to tell if they had evolved exactly the same track. They could be... Okay, yeah. It's like I can tell if I made... It's like building up a cheese platter. I eat some cheese which tastes 40 years old, some which tastes, you know, 6 months old. That's okay, you can tell the difference from it there. You can use the age related, but if there are two distinct cheeses which are both 20 years old, you're stuffed. Okay, statistical model can produce estimates of when the two groups mated and how different the other populations was from past ancestors. For the past few years, several attempts have been to refine these methods to apply them to Africa, the birthplace of our species, and setting a slice of our history that was known very little about. This research has revealed the presence of at least one ancient ghost on the continent, and that is a proper ghost. Yeah. It's not like... I suppose it's ghosts, but it's not ghosts, it's not like a new species. Basal Eurasians, people, Eurasians that didn't get on. And it's interesting, the Asians that have got Denisovans and the, and Neanderthals, but they don't have the, have much going in. Okay. African Neanderthals? Josh Astor of the University of Washington in Seattle, Sarah Tishkoff of the University of Pennsylvania, and others have spent years sequencing and analysing the genomes of modern Africans who belong to a group with a deep roots, including the Baka hunters and gatherers of Cameroon, and the Hazza and Sandwe of Tanzania. Within these genomes, they found stretches of DNA that appear to come from another hominid species. Because the DNA is found only in the descendants of African people, not Eurasians, the ghost species, they must have interbred with Homo sapiens after the out-of-African migrations long ago. Mm-hmm. Grant to that one. Probably this happened within past 30,000 years. If this is true, and this is huge, it means until very recently there was at least one other species of hominid living alongside us in Africa that suddenly became, you know what, you don't look so bad. I've seen you all the time, but now you look so much more beautiful to me. Okay. It means that until very recently there was at least one other species of hominid living alongside us in Africa. According to Ackley, soon to be published evidence suggests there might have been more than one. Okay, more than one species. African ghosts appear as an evolutionary distinct from modern humans, as Neanderthals and Denisovans are. What this means is that they probably came from the same African populations that the Neanderthals trace their ancestries to. Okay. So the idea is that 70,000 years ago, there's a population in Africa that splits off from a modern human lineage and goes out of Africa and becomes what we recognize as Neanderthals. At the same time, there's another split in Africa that becomes sort of like African Neanderthals. Who are these African Neanderthals? Where is a mystery? One clue could come from a fossil that Stringer worked with in his PhD in the 1970s. The two are a Kalu skull from Nigeria. It's around 13,000 years old, which is okay, that's in the right thing. This individual was alive just a millennium or so before some humans started farming. Yet, it has a strange mix of modern and primitive features. Recently, Stringer and Katrina Havati at the University of Tübingen in Germany did a fresh analysis of the skull. They confirmed that it's a very odd for its age. It actually resembles early sapient fossils rather than late ones. And it certainly doesn't look like any recent Africans, says Stringer. We suggest this could be an example of an African whose population had received this archaic introgression, as that's what we suggest, and we're sticking by. In other words, it might be a human whose ancestors mated with an African ghost. Ooh, oh, just it's really hard to compute all this type of stuff. So it's the little bits of this African population, which has got some 70,000. Okay, as yet, no ancient African hominid has a genome sequence, so it's possible that the physical remains of the ghosts have already been unearthed. One candidate is Homo naledi, a species discovered in 2013 deep inside a narrow cave system in South Africa. The fossils are around 250,000 years old, but no one knows how long the species survived. If pressed, however, Stringer would put this money on another suspect. My bet is Homo heidelbergensis as the introgressor, he says. Recently, unpublished evidence suggests that this species was still around less than 300,000 years ago, when humans had already appeared. Alternatively, now this is a bit complicated because they then remained isolated and then only mate. Can you imagine a bit of depravity? Alternatively, the ghosts may have been a subpopulation of Homo sapiens, like the Basal Eurasians, was isolated from another population for long enough that its members' DNA acquired different markers. I think that's unlikely because you've got the age of it. It could be the case that 100,000 years ago or more, there are different populations of anatomically modern humans in different parts of Africa. And maybe at some point they mix with each other, and maybe some of the populations die off. Tishcroft thinks that it would be surprising if our ancestors didn't mate with another ancient hominids in Africa. However, she cautions that the evidence for African ghosts is still tentative because we know so little about the population and history of Africa. She and her colleagues had made many assumptions to interpret the data. Quote, "That doesn't mean hybridization didn't occur in Africa," she says, says Tigoff. Quote, "It's likely to have occurred, it's just really challenging to prove. The clincher will come when someone is able to sequence DNA extracted from an African fossil and compare it with the fragments of ghost DNA found in modern Africans. That is a challenge, but given, this is the entire thing, I think this person's missed that the DNA has an age mark on it. Each part of your DNA sequence has an age mark on it, roughly speaking. That is a challenge, but given the advance in DNA sequencing in the past decade, it's probably only a matter of time before someone meets it. Quote, genetics in general is changing how we understand our species, says Thomas Marquis Bonnet at Pompeu Fabra University in Spain. To me, everything starts with the Denisonian. The first time we lifted DNA from our finger and found it was neither human or Neanderthal, something for which we have no face and very little other information, that was the first time genetics illuminated something that was totally escaped paleontology. It now transpires that the Demosthenians had their own ghosts. People living in Oceania and East Southeast Asia today have inherited about 5% of the DNA from Demosthenian. By taking a closer look at these genetic sequences, it seems that they don't all relate to the original finger bone genome in the same way. In fact, the group found signs of two evolutionarily distinct Demosthenian populations. That was really unexpected, he says. There's actually another ghost, a Demosthenian lineage. What all these studies highlight is that it was the rule rather than the exception for hominid populations to split for thousands, or even hundreds of thousands of years, and then to meet again and say, meet. They go, ooh, neat. Bifurcating evolutionary trees must be abandoned. Take a pen on a piece of paper and start making squiggly lines, says Ashley. That's human history. Well, yeah. On a more basic level, it's also causing many of the fields to stop using the term species and subspecies and refer to different hominids, as you think you should, preferring instead to talk about groups of populations. After all, individuals that belong to different species, like Homo sapiens and Homo neanderthals, aren't meant to be able to produce viable offsprings. That's my entire thing. They're not subspecies if they can produce a group. Yeah, it's just contradiction, slap in your face, contradiction. It's like dogs being different species. You know, you can't put two dogs. Oh my god, my Dachshund and my King Charles, they just, you know, they're different species. Because the dog shows, so they're different species. Ghosts and nearly ghosts are making the ancient world a much less lonely place. If we look around the world today, we're really the only human hominid game in town, says Ackley. People assume that's the way it must have always been. In fact, the world was a much more interesting place not that long ago.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.